Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Welcome everyone to the Really 007 podcast for another look at Bond books, but this time a really different book. It's all about one of the biggest and most impactful video games of all time, GoldenEye 007 on the N64. And we're joined by the author of that book, Elise Knorr. Good evening, Elise.
Hi, thanks so much for having me, y'all.
Well, it's great to have you, and we didn't know that you were a listener of the show as well.
Oh yeah, I got really into James Bond research for this book, and so I tried to read and listen and watch as widely as I could, and y'all are really the signature James Bond podcast.
Oh, wow.
That's very kind, but...
Thank you.
I'm sure you didn't learn anything for your research there. Just a load of nonsense, but...
Once you got over the excessive cackling and laughing, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's just such a beautiful thing, this deep fandom and your deep knowledge. And I love pop culture, you know, hearing reactions to, like, the films and just kind of hearing everybody's takes. That's my kind of thing.
Oh, well, that's very kind of you to say so, and we appreciate it. Sam is one of those people who's we've only found through the podcast itself.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
Sam Rogers, that's the voice of, if you didn't know. Yeah. Who's pretty much our resident video game expert. So he's like the Jim Fanning of the video game world.
I'll take that. I'll take the Jim Fanning of the video game world. I will. He's not necessarily the best, but he's definitely a part of it. And that's the main thing. So.
Yeah.
You've got the cartridge right behind you in the background there. That's so cool.
Well, I used to do radio stuff. And so every time I did student radio, especially, I would come in either in a t-shirt or have something that was related to the topic that we're talking about. And my friend who I did it with was like, Sam, why do you always dress the set or do something? I'm like, I don't know. No one's watching, but I'm just going to do it anyway because it helps me get in the zone. And I find having that stuff around you really kind of puts you in that mindset. So I had to get GoldenEye out for this one.
So cool.
Well, that is amazing. And that will be what we'll be talking about most of the time. But before we get to that, there's also John to say hello to John.
Hello. Good to be here.
And I think John, like me, we were brought up really with Pierce Brosnan as our Bond film, our Bond, and with GoldenEye as the game we all played. So going back to our childhood, it's really, really nice to sort of revisit that. Through the game, through your book, Elise. Yeah. So looking forward to chatting about it.
Definitely.
Me too. I'm excited.
So yes, if you are new to the podcast, you can find loads of other episodes, which are on YouTube. We've got some video interviews there and some features. We've also got all our episodes, though, on iTunes and Spotify. And we've got a website at Pod Dojo, if you just look that up. And we're part of that network, which has lots of other podcasts, which are all all very interesting, all very varied. So check them out. We're also on social media, as you may be aware. So we're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And please follow us, give us a recommendation. Keep listening and keep joining in on the chat. That'd be great. Because of what we're talking about tonight, I just wanted to give a special shout out to all the fans of the Bond video games, because we haven't really focused on them an awful lot. We've done a bit of Nightfire with Sam before, so we've interviewed the composer of Nightfire and Everything or Nothing, Jeff Timoshuk, and we've also done, I think, the songs from those two from those two video games, and again, Sam was involved in that. But we really haven't spent hardly any time, for some reason, on GoldenEye, the game. So I'm really looking forward to this, Elise. Before we talk about that, let's just get to know you, really. So how did you get into the world of writing to start with?
You know, I was one of those kids that just grew up always with a book. I always loved reading and writing. I used to make my dad write little stories down that I dictated to him before I even knew how to read or write. And growing up, I kept up with it. I just thought it was so much fun to tell stories and read stories. Went to school for creative writing and journalism, which is where I picked up a lot of the sort of interview skills that I needed for the GoldenEye books research. I went to grad school for poetry, so poetry is sort of my home genre. But then at some point I saw an announcement through Boss Fight Books that they were accepting proposals for books about video games. And I thought, that sounds kind of fun, writing a documentary book about a video game. I pitched a book about Super Mario Brothers 3, which is a super important game in my past. Got it accepted, worked with Gabe Durham, the editor of Boss Fight Books, and just had an absolute blast getting into games writing. And then a few years later, I felt inspired to write a book about GoldenEye. And now I've written two books for Boss Fight and haven't looked back.
Wow.
You said an awful lot there. Goodness me. I mean, so the poetry, I'm really interested in that sort of what poems have you done? And I know you've won some awards for them.
Yeah. I've published three books of poetry and four chapbooks, which are kind of like half poetry books. And I've got two more coming out. One's coming out in September and one in March. I write a lot of love poems, especially about my wife and my kids. I write a lot of poems about nature and the environment. I'm really interested in science, and so I'll kind of write poems about different new scientific discoveries or innovations. And poetry's always just felt like my native tongue, like the easiest way to express myself.
We'll have to check some of that out. That's amazing. Mm.
Thank you. It's very kind.
You mentioned your wife and your kids. Are they Bond fans? We have to ask this.
It's a great question. So I'm one of those millennials that sort of played GoldenEye before I'd ever seen any Bond movies. GoldenEye, the game, brought me to the world of James Bond. And my wife's the same way. So she didn't play the game, but she grew up with the Daniel Craig Bond the Pierce Brosnan Bond and then the Daniel Craig Bond. And we have, inspired by your show, actually decided to this summer, while we have our newborn home with us all day, to watch all the Bond films from start to finish. We've only made it through Dr. No, and it took us four nights in a row because our baby kept waking up and crying. He didn't like all the gunshots. Yeah, I'm really excited I've seen Bond films here and there, right? But I've never watched them sort of chronologically, and there's lots of gaps in my Bond knowledge. So that's our current mission.
Well, we actually haven't, well, certainly I haven't watched them all in chronological order until you're probably aware that in the UK, I'm sorry they weren't there in North America, but all the Bonds were shown at the cinema once a week for the 60th anniversary. So that was, that was an incredible experience. And in fact, Sam came to a lot of those with us. So that was great.
I loved listening to y'all's reactions for those. It was so exciting to be able to have that, like, fresh out of the theater. I just saw this Bond movie that's existed for maybe 30 years, but now we're getting this hot take on it. I mean, it's so much fun.
Oh, I hope you weren't too jealous that you couldn't see them at the cinema yourself.
A little jealous.
So growing up then, you said you got into them because of the game. Does that mean Pierce, I think I know the answer, but Pierce, you say in the book, Pierce Brosnan is when you shut your eyes, that's who you think of as Bond.
It really is. I think it's just because he's the one I grew up with. And I talk a little bit in my book about just the idea that Pierce Brosnan really represented the era and that generation of Bond so well, right? Like his sort of dexterity with technology and his, campy and funny enough for the 90s, but also more serious than maybe like Roger Moore or something. So he's kind of that perfect fit for that changing era from Dalton into Craig, and from the 90s into the 2000s, and a time of, you know, fighting the Cold War to maybe fighting terrorists and new enemies. You know, there's just a lot of innovations and changes that happened with GoldenEye. So I think bringing Pierce Brosnan in as the new Bond for that movie was the perfect choice, and really helped reset the franchise and establish something new as well.
You're from Denver, Colorado, aren't you? So
I'm from Georgia, actually. So from Georgia, I grew up down south. Yeah, I grew up down south, just outside of Atlanta. Now, really? I've lived in Denver for about 8 years now, though.
That's fantastic, yeah. I mean, Pierce was quite famous, wasn't he, for Remington Steel. I know this is before our time, really, isn't it? But yeah. That's how he was acknowledged in America. I think he was quite famous there, wasn't he?
Yeah, I think that the Bond folks had wanted him for the role of Bond before Dalton. I'm sure you know all this, but he had to go and do Remington Steel, and so he couldn't take on the role, and so that's how he ends up with Timothy Dalton. So it's kind of cool that, you know, when he came in, it was like this long-awaited thing that he was really destined, I think, to inhabit that role. And I kind of love the way that when they announced that he was going to be the next Bond, he was wearing a full beard at the time. And yeah. So then it's kind of like everyone's like, is that going to work? Like, is that? And then it's almost like one of those 90s makeover movies. Like he shaves off his beard. You see that chiseled jaw and you're like, oh, yeah, he's Bond. Like that's a little twinkle in his eye. Oh, so great.
I mean, we haven't seen Remington Steel really here in the UK, but we'd certainly seen Mrs. Doubtfire, and he looks good, doesn't he, in that film?
Hey, how yes, about Mamma Mia? How about Mamma Mia?
Oh,
his,
well.
Yeah. You know, his scene.
I love it.
He sounds great in that film.
Yeah.
Just sounds like Pierce Brosnan, doesn't it? You can't argue with that.
I actually watched the Outlaws last night.
Oh, right.
It's absolutely dreadful. However, it is well worth watching for Pierce Brosnan's Northern Irish accent alone. That's the only thing. Yeah.
Oh, I bet that's awesome.
Yeah. You don't often hear him do the Irish accent, do you?
Well, no, but he's that's it, because he's got such a mixed up accent anyway. But this is him specifically doing Irish accent, but he goes Northern Irish to kind of accentuate it more.
Yeah.
Absolutely fascinating. You know, I just like...
Is it good? Yeah. Is it good or bad or...
Well, right. Yeah, it's relatively accurate. I mean, I've got to be honest, when I see Brosnan on screen, I can never say anything negative about the man. I just love him to bits. You better ask him, my wife, who probably has a bit more of an impartial view of it, and she could tell you if it was good or not. I'm just like, this is the greatest thing ever. We'll have to see.
Which is your favourite Bond film then, having sort of seen them all now?
Well, I'm so early still in my comprehensive watch through, right? Because we really only did like Dr. No and started the next movie. But I mean, is it cliche if I say GoldenEye? It inhabits so much of my childhood, and even like the connections to Austin Powers and what a source of inspiration it was for that. I have to say GoldenEye. It's just it defines my. I was 10 when it came out, and so it was sort of like the first movie that I was allowed to see that was, you know, PG-13, and I really resonated with it because of the game.
Oh yeah, absolutely brilliant. Yeah, and it was amazing. Going on to the book, how long had you sort of thought about writing the book? Because it's a big task, isn't it? And the amount of research you've done for it is immense, really.
Yeah, what happened was that I was kind of online, and I would read every once in a while the GoldenEye developers would come out with a new interview or a new oral history, or there were just constantly these BuzzFeed articles that are like 10 things you didn't know about GoldenEye's development. Mm-hmm. And it was there were these fascinating little bits and pieces of trivia of how GoldenEye was made. But there were also gaps in that trivia. And so I have a bit of a collector's impulse, and I like to gather. And so I thought, you know, it would be nice to sort of gather all of these histories into one sort of definitive, comprehensive, linear story of how this game came to being and close up some of those gaps and investigate some of those mysteries in the game's creation. I think being an aging millennial, right, like being a millennial entering my 30s and sort of seeing how our childhood culture is now foregrounded as nostalgia in the media, it really made me think about that game a lot more, about how big a role it played in my childhood, how big a role it played, all the way from middle school up through college. And just like what it means to have a game that can define a generation. All those questions became super interesting to me and made me think maybe I should pitch a book about this game.
I mean, who do you go to? Because it's very niche subjects, isn't it?
Yeah, so Boss Fight Books does individual books about individual games. So each book in their series is about a game. And they've covered games on every major platform from all the eras of gaming, all the genres of gaming, everything from, arcade Space Invader knockoffs all the way up through, GoldenEye, contemporary games, niche games you've never heard of, and super, super famous games like Super Mario 3. And so I had already worked with Gabe Durham, the editor at Boss Fight, on the Super Mario 3 book. And so I went to him, and he's never had up until then, he had never had a Boss Fight author do two books. So I was like, Gabe, I know you might be sick of me by now, but let me just pitch you this other book on GoldenEye. I think we should cover this book. It's a really good story to tell. And I sort of wrote him a little prospectus and wrote him a sample chapter and sent it his way. And I was really excited that he wanted to work with me again. He's a fabulous editor.
Had you already done the Super Mario Brothers 3 book?
Yes. Well, yeah, that book came out in 2016. And that was a real big jump for me to go from poetry to nonfiction and to the world of video games writing. I'd always been a fan of games, but certainly never considered myself someone with, an encyclopedic or expert knowledge of games. I'm just a fan, but a fan with a really strong connection with the game. I played that game with my father when I was growing up, and it was just really special memories with him. And also a fan with sort of a little bit of journalistic skills and a lot of curiosity for the game. And so that's what guided me through my first adventure into video games writing.
Sam, you're a fan of that game, are you?
I would find it difficult to find anyone who isn't a fan of at least one Mario title. It's one of those kind of, it's such a cross-generational piece of media that at least for anyone who's kind of between, well, either a child now up till probably someone in their 40s, maybe 50s, with how early the first game came out. So I think even that as a subject, I think there's so many different types of Mario media that you could talk about. So I think talking about that game, which I've not played through completely, but I know how important that is, and especially kind of the early Mario games that then lead into the 3D world with N64's, Super Mario 64. So it is important and good that you touched upon kind of that being kind of the main title for that console, and kind of leading the way, even though it really sounds like it was difficult for the team at Rare to access the N64 for quite a while, which even just reading that kind of infuriated me, because in my mind, how are you allowing a team to make a game for this new console and not allowing them, giving them the tools to help them do that in a refined, faster way?
Yeah, it's pretty wild that they were designing the game with a sort of butchered Sega Genesis controller. They didn't have the controller, so they didn't have that. They didn't know what the N64 could do. And this also really affected the composers, because they were told the N64 would have a certain amount of capabilities of memory and RAM and processing speed, and it didn't. None of the things they were promised, the artists, the gameplay designers, and the musicians, they did not get any of that delivered. So the late stages of the game development was a lot of rushed, kind of making things smaller, making things fit, making things run. In some ways that's really frustrating, but in other ways game designers kind of love that. They think it's fun sometimes to get a constraint thrown in that they have to work around. They often find, they talk to me a lot about how creativity or constraint breeds creativity and gives them a fun challenge. Just like we like our games really hard, and we like Bond's missions to be, seem nearly impossible to complete, and that's what makes them so exciting. It's the same thing with game design.
And I guess it would be completely different if they were being told, it has even more capabilities that you weren't aware of, and now you're going to have to work towards that, rather than going, you've already done a lot of work, now you can kind of like look at that and kind of compress some of the things and kind of strip some things down, which I guess is disappointing, but more manageable than having to create more things, I guess.
Right, right. And I could really relate to that as a writer because I tend to write long and write way, way, way too much. I mean, the first draft of this book was probably like 6 times longer than it needed to be.
Wow.
Like, it's just massive. I want to put everything in and then cut it down and narrow it down and narrow it down and narrow it down. And I like the idea that I'm cutting things away rather than things being missing that I have to go in and add. And then you get like extra content you can go and pitch to Kotaku or Nintendo Life or whatever for additional articles, like bonus articles about other things. Yeah, I could relate to that problem they had. Maybe not the worst thing.
I mean, you've spoken to loads of the team from Rare, of course, who were based in England, weren't they? I mean, that's quite unusual that they developed the game GoldenEye.
Yeah. So they were a team of brothers that started in the 80s under the name Ultimate Play the Game. They're sort of prodigies. They were just really gifted game designers, taught themselves how to code, taught themselves how to make games, and built their company from scratch, just with members of their own family, started growing it and growing it. They were incredibly hardworking guys. They wouldn't take any time off except for like maybe Christmas morning every year. And they were just blowing up. Ultimate games were some of the most popular, especially in England throughout the 80s. And then into the 90s, they changed their name. They kind of disappeared Ultimate and rebranded themselves as Rare. Rare really produced some of the best games for the Nintendo 64 in the 90s. To the extent that, you know, I make the argument in the book that they may have saved Nintendo during that period. Nintendo's games were great, but the ones that Rare made for Nintendo's platforms were some of the most legendary. And yeah, so all, you know, I think it's kind of an interesting story of localization, cross-cultural communication that these, you know, British guys made, you know, a game about a British hero for a Japanese company that then became particularly popular in America for American audiences. An American studio made the Bond film. So a lot of interesting cross-cultural connections there.
A long time since it was a purely British thing in the 60s. It's developed, and I think that's good. I think it's good that when we had the first American director, am I right, with No Time to Die, I think.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. I didn't know that.
I think it is, which is
cool. Yeah. I think that Nintendo really did want to give a British company, and not only were they giving Rare all their projects during this time, because they really trusted Rare with everything, I think they thought, you know, a British company needs to make a Bond game. And of course, the guys on the team were ecstatic, because they had grown up watching all the Bond movies on the BBC, and he was their hero, and they were all Bond nerds. So I think they had a lot of fun with it and sort of drew upon their extensive knowledge of not just GoldenEye the movie, but on Bond history and Bond's lore for the GoldenEye game.
The players in multiplayer, you know, like Baron Samedi, I mean, that's one of the reasons why he's so famous. I mean, he was, of course, famous from Live and Let Die, but having him in the multiplayer sort of gave him a new life for young fans. And yeah, you're absolutely right. And they only sort of, you'd only know and want to do that if you're a Bond fan, you know, because it wouldn't make sense, would it, if you had another game with characters from other films and stuff.
Right, they got an extraordinary license to use absolutely anything and everything from the Bond films, except the likenesses of Connery, Dalton, and Moore.
Yes.
They're not allowed to use that, but everything else they could use, including the music. And no Bond game made before or since had as liberal a license as that. So they could create levels based on Moonraker alongside, you know, the GoldenEye game, and they could include Baron, all these wonderful characters, which I think makes it super fun.
And just to add to that, I mean, in your book, there's a phenomenal picture of Dalton, Connery, and Moore. I mean, on the N64, and it just gets the creative mind, the imagination flowing of just playing as Timothy Dalton with that sniper from Living Daylights on GoldenEye would just be, well, we're talking like heaven, aren't we, basically, you know?
Yes, agreed. It's in the code somewhere still. You can mod it, or you can find a Dalton mod online if you wanted to hook up a USB controller to your laptop.
Whoa, right. Whoa.
You're good.
Sam, good. Come on, son.
But
here we go.
I have a weird form of Mandela effects where I feel like I have this memory literally of like seeing those Bonds, like when I was so young. It wouldn't have been me accessing the internet or anything like that, and I just kind of wonder, was there any way that the game could have just been cracked to allow that or not? Because it just feels like I've always known that there's been some way to play it, unless it was, I think there's like an image of Connery, and that was still about whether that's what's making me think that or not. But it just, I can't even imagine what that would have been like to have been able to do that. I just think it would have been insane.
Totally. I mean, one of the best mods of the game, fan-made mod, which you can buy on eBay, and it comes in like an N64 cartridge and an N64 cartridge box, is Goldfinger. So they used only the art assets from GoldenEye, including the Connery Bond. Mm. They put them all in a game that completely traces the plot of Goldfinger very faithfully and reliably. And it's a hard game, and it's super, super fun, for all the same reasons GoldenEye was fun.
And did you say this is on eBay? Is that right?
Yeah, I'll put a link in the chat. I'm
just typing it into eBay, right?
Yeah, I'm gonna Google Goldfinger game. You can get it if you still have your old school, you know, N64 actual console. You can play this, and it's amazing. $40.
It is mad. I thought it when I first heard about that. I thought, well, it's not gonna be great. It'll use assets from GoldenEye. Fine, whatever. But then I remember seeing a video during lockdown, and I was like, whoa, this is kind of insane how much detail has gone into it. Like, and that's when you just see the love and the fact that it's so much like GoldenEye in its look and feel, yet does a completely different thing. It's amazing, really.
The modders who made it actually consulted with the GoldenEye guys, because the GoldenEye developers are some of the most generous, humble, sweet men you'll ever meet. And so they love this kind of thing. This makes them really happy when fans want to take their work and remix it and run with it. So the modders did reach out to them for like help on different coding problems. And the GoldenEye guys were like, yeah, here you go. Okay, I'm sending this link in the chat to y'all. And it's the Etsy. It's on Etsy, which is probably the most respectable place to buy it.
Yeah. Oh, fantastic.
Unbelievable.
Well, they did in the book. You've got the sort of fan arts. And there it is on the cartridge, yeah.
They tried to make it as close to a real experience of like the GoldenEye sequel you never had as a kid but always wanted, you know, which I really appreciate.
Oh my word.
I think we're going to have to get that, aren't we?
There's only one left, so the three of you are going to have to fight over it.
I can share it, guys. My word.
Sam, have you got a working N64?
Well, I do, but it's not coming up on screen. I tried to plug it in a few months ago, and it just wasn't coming up on screen. And so it's one of those where I've got a different cable, and it did work, and now it's not, because I completed GoldenEye for the first time, like fully start to finish, about 4 years ago or something. And it was the first time that I'd seen like the end credit scene. I was like, oh my God. Finally, after 2 decades, basically, have done it. But it's got in because, like, I would love to do like multiplayer. I've got, you know, Mario Kart. I've got Banjo-Kazooie. Yeah. I wish I had Donkey Kong. This thing, Rare, did Donkey Kong and Banjo-Kazooie, which were two of my other favorite games on the N64. So it's kind of crazy how much influence that company at that specific time had and how creative they were. Yeah. It is insane. But I did just look, actually, and there are videos, and I've seen it pop up of, I don't know if it's the same team who've done Goldfinger 64, but there's also a Tomorrow Never Dies 64. Ooh. And a Spy Who Loved Me, Spy Who Loved Me 64. It's fairly recent. I don't know if the full things, if it's from the same people who've done Goldfinger, but I think it's so funny and just so amazing. No Bond games are out now, so make your own, and I think
this is unbelievable. Yeah. But, I mean, without ranting, well, I am ranting, but so what? Yeah. But this is amazing, that the frustration of the lack of business that's going on from Eon and from the company, all this, fans are actually driving things forward. Fans are creating content everywhere. And this is just incredible. You know, the Bond fans, to me, are the best, I've got to say. We do just crack on.
Yeah. You know, he really inspires people to get creative, and of course, like, he's a vessel. You want to be him and play as him, and so people do get really creative with these efforts, and I love that.
I'm thinking we should like purchase this Goldfinger, and let's have a day where we just do it together on a multiplayer.
I want to mention a project that's being built by a Bond mega fan who wanted to recreate GoldenEye sort of frame by frame modern, I think in the Unreal Engine with modern day graphics.
Yeah, yeah.
Of course, this exists already now because they're really, really re-releasing it on Xbox and Switch. But he went for years recreating scene for scene, you know, level for level GoldenEye in the Unreal Engine before he got slapped with a copyright violation. Yeah. And now he's still going with the game. He's just renamed it Final Transmission. So he's just one guy. He's just one guy that's recreating the game, and now it's under this other name, so it's safe from a copyright standpoint. But it's definitely worth checking out because it has that feel of being a secret. He's not allowed to say Bond anymore, but it's like has that feeling of being Bond secret agent, and it's super fun.
The possibilities are endless, aren't they? I did see again in your book that they did have the three previous actors, so they had Sean, Roger, and George. No, they didn't have George, did they? No, they had Tim. I think as the third. But you could have, with Pierce, you could have done the four in multiplayer, which I think they intended. But then copyright again, you can't. They would have had to pay for the likenesses for each actor, which would have cost a lot of money. So you can understand why. I think it was MGM who blocked it. Is that right? I think.
Yeah. It was just they were going to have to pay those individual actors so much money. So they still had the really broad license for everything else, but. Those three actors, they would have paid the entire budget of the game just to Connery,
yeah.
Just as a fraction of what Connery wanted. But they did, one of my favorite anecdotes from them is like, as a way of kind of honoring and sending out the other Bonds, they had a multiplayer deathmatch between the four Bonds to see, like,
yeah.
At the end of the day, like, which is the best Bond? And I think Roger Moore won, which is so fun to think about.
Yes. That's so good. Yeah. The one that people don't really think of is the action.
Right, he won. It's fabulous.
Yeah. I mean, multiplayer was a massive part of the success. I'm not sure, was it the first multiplayer shooter ever existed? I might be wrong on that, but it's certainly the first one I played.
Yeah, so what explains for that is there were other first-person shooters before that. Doom was one of the big ones, Castle Wolfenstein. First-person shooters go all the way back to like the 1960s, 70s, but they were all on PCs. So if you only played console games, which a lot of people did, I only played console games, I didn't play any PC games, then GoldenEye was likely your first introduction to first-person shooters. It's really the game that brought the first-person shooter genre from PCs onto consoles and beyond.
Was there a Doom multiplayer? I'm not sure there was there?
You could play on sort of like networked computers. Like using like LAN wires. And in fact, the GoldenEye developers played a lot of networked Doom in their office as they worked on GoldenEye. So you'll kind of see some of Doom's DNA in GoldenEye while you play it. Yeah.
Hi, this is Jeff Timischuk. I was one of the composers on Everything or Nothing and Nightfire. And you're listening to Really 007.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
I mean, I know one of the guys, of course, who did it was David Doak, who put himself in the game. He's a new character for the GoldenEye game.
Gosh, yes. Such a funny story. They were all really young developers. Only two of them on the 8-person team had ever worked on a game before, and even then it was like very low level, basically like an intern's work. So they were just like very young, fresh out of college, and some of them hadn't gone to college. They were just kind of playing a lot and having a lot of fun. And one of the things they did was put David Doak in as a character in the game, and their bosses saw it and said, absolutely not, take him out right now. And they said, okay, we'll do that. And then they did not do that. And
all right,
they at several stages in the development process went explicitly against what their bosses were telling them to do. And their bosses told them they were not allowed to make a multiplayer mode, and they did it in secret. So they're very naughty guys, and they just were very independent and did it their own way. And now David Doak to this day is kind of like a mascot for the game. If you go to David Doak's Twitter page, his avatar picture is the in-game GoldenEye David Doak, Dr. Doak. and a lot of people don't know this, but he was called Dr. Doak in the game because he's a doctor in real life. He has a PhD in biochemistry.
Wow.
So really amazing story.
I love it. Absolutely love it. So they were basically a launch themselves, but certainly Nintendo were really like desperate that it come out as soon as possible. And there'd been delays, haven't there, on the N64 itself. And then everyone was waiting for this game because it wasn't just like, do it in the next few months, it'll come out this day, and then that's the end of it, was it? It was quite a complicated stage to get to releasing it.
Yeah, the game came out a pretty embarrassing 2 years after the movie. When nobody was even really thinking about the movie anymore. They got dangerously close to the next movie coming out before their game was finished. And luckily they got it in under the wire, but they were just, they were new to game design, and they had bosses who were really, the bosses were definitely getting worried. The Stamper brothers, who ran Rare, were like, you really need to finish this game. Like we can't keep blowing past deadlines. But they also gave them a lot of flexibility to work at a pace that allowed them to do super creative, innovative things. So I do think that if it had been rushed, we wouldn't have the same game we have today. But at the same time, it was definitely a lot of delays, especially toward the end.
It took a while for people to really, for it to explode, didn't it? And then became one of the best-selling games ever, didn't it?
Yeah, that's actually a really interesting thing, is that the sales were disappointing at first. I mean, they were fine, but they were not a blockbuster explosive thing. It was really word of mouth and a slow and steady build in sales that made GoldenEye the kind of cult classic it was. It was people playing the game at their friends' houses at sleepovers. I mean, that's such a social game that word of mouth really worked because people could talk about the game. It was also featured really heavily in the Nintendo Power magazine. So people saw it there and kind of slowly wanted to buy it more. And the Nintendo of America people did some really clever promoting work with Blockbuster, where they sort of gave Blockbuster a deal on rental copies. And so people were also renting the game, buying it, and falling in love with it. I think at the time you had a lot of people who had bought only a PlayStation or only a Sega. And they didn't even have an N64, but then a lot of people bought an N64 just because they saw this game after it had been out for a while. They saw how popular it was and they wanted it. So slow and steady. And then the awards started pouring in. And so, by the end of 1997, going into 1998, the game had been nominated for every single game design award under the sun.
The only reason I got into it was staying at a friend's at a sleepover's house and he put it on. That was the only reason I first played it. So I totally identify with that. And never looked back since.
I actually have some friends visiting right now from out of town. None of them had ever played GoldenEye. And we're all in our 30s and 40s. I sat them down and we played GoldenEye all night the other night. We played Slappers Only. These are people who didn't grow up with any kind of video games. My wife even played, and she's never beat a video game in her life, but she did beat all of us on Slappers Only. And so it's very inviting.
Slappers only.
Yeah.
That's the thing though, isn't it, now, is that, 20 whatever years on, 30 years on or whatever, people do this now, but they do it with COD. And it's like GoldenEye set that trend most certainly, I feel.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that one thing that really came through when I was talking to the developers is that they played constantly through the whole time they were making the game. They played with each other. Whether it was Doom or Super Bomberman or Mario Kart, they played all these games with each other. And then once they had enough game to play the game, they played GoldenEye with each other constantly. Everything they did, they play tested it to see if it was fun. And all these really silly, hilarious things like Slappers Only, or the fact that everything explodes when you shoot it, even tables and chairs. All of this comes down to the fact that these were, eight real life, young men playing the game, having fun. And so that like core fun was part of its process all along.
Like you say, it was so successful that people bought the N64 just to play that game. They even sold it, didn't they, as a GoldenEye edition where you got the game with the console.
Yeah.
They did. And I think that, you know, when you look at the sales numbers for the N64 and the sales numbers for GoldenEye, it really kind of indicates that this was one of the, you know, most important titles, especially titles that weren't packaged with the game, like Super Mario 64. Yeah. But also it was an important point for Nintendo, because Nintendo was trying to figure out whether they wanted to keep making only games for kids, or whether they wanted to start competing with, you know, PlayStation and then later Xbox for more of an adult audience. So games like Conker's Bad Fur Day or GoldenEye sort of let people know, you know, you can keep playing video games even as you age. You don't need to, you know, this isn't a thing just for childhood. So those of us who grew up with Nintendo consoles, I think the N64 and GameCube, it's kind of darker periods, gave us a transition point to continue gaming into adulthood.
I was going to say, there's something quite inspirational about the process and how it was created, because it is, as you said, it's kind of like a ragtag group of people who've just come from, you know, somewhat similar backgrounds, but really kind of working on this huge project together. What is also kind of inspiring, I guess, is how kind of long it took for it to pick up steam and for people to start enjoying it, because I feel like that's something that a lot of people don't have the luxury of having in the nowadays, especially with how instantaneous things are. It's either things need to make money straight away, or that's it. And you see that a lot in kind of, especially with like streaming and television, you know, things get taken off a platform because it doesn't do very well. It's not given the time. Whereas, you know, back then, I think that's why a lot of people idolize the 90s, especially, that it just felt like people were given the opportunities to try. And if it didn't work, then it doesn't matter. Like, just do something else or keep going. And I really like felt that through the book, and by being able to hear about each individual and how they started and what they brought to the table. And you kind of, even though you know it's going to be successful, you kind of hope it's a success, even though you know it is.
Yeah, I mean, these guys were really growing up while they worked on this game. They were cutting their teeth on this game. They were learning things. And then after the game came out, I have a chapter where I talk about how a lot of them had to sort of negotiate for the first time in their professional lives, like, I need you to pay me more, or I'm going to leave, or like, you know, thanks for this watch. The Stamper guys gave them all a fancy watch as a reward or a thank you when the game came out. And so a way for a lot of these guys to kind of start learning, like, no, I need more leadership opportunities, or I need. So they're really kind of like, a lot of them had their very first job on this game, and then they're sort of growing in their professional lives, which is story I like to tell. And as far as the hype question goes, what's really interesting is that when I wrote about Super Mario 3, it's total opposite of GoldenEye. Mario 3, you had Shigeru Miyamoto, Koji Kondo, these people who were already legends coming back to work on Mario 3, which was so highly anticipated. Everyone was dying for this game to come out. Everyone knew about it coming out. And still the marketing campaign was massive. You had a major motion picture, The Wizard, you had Happy Meal toys, TV commercials, TV shows, breakfast cereal. The game was everywhere, and it delivered, versus GoldenEye, which is like, no one expected this game to be good. No one knew this game was coming out. It was a bunch of nobodies working on it. It got no promotion after it came out at all, like barely TV commercials, and then it takes off. It's just really interesting, the two different trajectories.
And have you played any of the former Bond games? I mean, was it James Bond the Duel on the Sega Genesis, the Mega Drive? That was about it, was it?
Yeah, and there was, you know, there's all kinds of weird little things. There was a card game. There were board games. So I definitely like looked at, you know, YouTube playthroughs and sort of looked at some of that research. But I'm very interested in the fact that that GoldenEye was the first and the last hugely successful James Bond game. Of course, there's other Bond games that follow that you may or may not have enjoyed, but none of them were as critically acclaimed or, you know, commercially successful, or as culturally cherished today, you know, years later, as GoldenEye. So how strange is that this wildly successful film franchise, I mean, the longest running film franchise of all time, has just the one game, and that there hasn't been a Bond game out in 10 years, in a decade, because GoldenEye kind of ruined it for everyone.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there was that, wasn't it, that nothing could touch it? And I know that that was part of the reason, wasn't it, why Rare said, we've done Bond now, we need to move on. Because it's just, I know it was like years of their lives, but and they even tried to do, didn't they, GoldenEye Rogue Agent game. So they just trying to live off that gamers. Gamers are more, it's more synonymous with GoldenEye than James Bond almost, really.
Absolutely.
But Sam, you will defend some of the others, weren't you? Nightfire and Everything or Nothing, mainly.
Oh, I mean, I think the EA set of games that came out afterwards. So I know, I think they did everything from Tomorrow Never Dies up till From Russia With Love. And I think the vast majority of them are actually, you know, playable today, fairly good. I think there's a unanimous reaction to Rogue Agent. I don't think there's many people who like it. I think the one thing it has going for it is its multiplayer, which similarly to GoldenEye has, you know, iconic set pieces. It has the Golden Gate Bridge from A View to a Kill, and it has the Centrifuge from Moonraker. It has these iconic pieces. They're just in the wrong game, which is really disappointing. But yeah, it's a shame that game developers, so EA and Activision, have both tried to use the GoldenEye name for their benefit, when really they should have just focused on making the best game, I think, really, over the branding, because it's Bond speaks for itself, and really you're not going to get away from the comparison to the original, so why try and make even more comparisons by doing something somewhat similar.
A really great point. I mean, it's so tough that every game that comes out has to live in the shadow of this game. They're always going to be compared every single time. And even some of the GoldenEye developers that I talked to said they kind of feel sorry for game developers who have worked on these other games, because they, you know, it's so hard to judge them, you know, in isolation as apart from GoldenEye. And I think one of them said to me about the GoldenEye 2010 sort of remake with Daniel Craig, you know, nothing can compare to GoldenEye, not even GoldenEye. I just thought that was really, so how much of it is just, you know, lightning in a bottle, but just like there was something about this time and this group of people, this team. It's actually very strange when you think about it, because so many of those other games were really well designed and really beautiful and really fun, but they never got like the total like cultural, you know, fascination and zeitgeist of GoldenEye, and who knows why.
Ones that have like are popular amongst fans are the original stories that have been since. So stuff like Nightfire, Everything or Nothing, Agent Under Fire. And I think that's a really interesting point, because what they are not doing is they are deliberately not trying to recreate GoldenEye. They're deliberately trying to do their own thing. And I think those kind of games have accepted what they are. And whilst they are not as critically or commercially loved as GoldenEye, they are very much cherished amongst Bond fans. But I do think when you've had ones that have tried to follow the idea of GoldenEye, as in making a game out of a movie, The World Is Not Enough is the perfect example for me, which I actually think on the N64 was a very, very underrated game. I thought it was very good. However, you're never going to capture that moment again. That moment's gone. And in some bizarre world, this game enhances the film. Do you know?
Oh, yeah.
It's such a bizarre... It is lightning in a bottle. That's the best way to describe it. And I don't think it'll happen again, to be honest.
A lot of it too comes down to timing. And so Howard Phillips at Nintendo of America told me this about Super Mario Brothers 3 too. Like the timing of when the game comes out and what else is out at the same time. So when GoldenEye came out, you know, if you had an N64 and you wanted a really fun game to play with your friends, you basically had GoldenEye and you had Mario Kart. And so if you're like a teenage boy and you have your friends over, and it's like GoldenEye is the option. It's the option. So it's a great game. It's a well-designed game. It's a beautiful game. But also the timing is just kind of like forces it to become the object of fascination in a lot of ways too.
I mean, when it came out, it was such the graphics, I remember, were so high, so much better than 32-bit consoles. Mm-hmm. And certainly in England, the N64... I think the few people who had it just played Mario, really, up until that point. Like, even the Star Wars one didn't really sort of take off in England, certainly. Yeah. And it was this game, and the Rumble Pack as well. Because that was just... I couldn't believe that. You could... When you were... And the silence, the noise of the silencer, it's just the stuff of dreams that... Particularly as a Bond fan and lads who... Like, we used to sort of go out into the garden and play James Bond and just chase and pretend to be shooting each other. And it's that kind of zeitgeist, I think, that it really successfully molded.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, like you mentioned the kind of like what was this era like for England in particular? And I just want to also mention, I didn't get as much time to talk about this in my book as I would like to, but GoldenEye the game is very much a product of the British bedroom coders, you know, the generation of young British men that had been taught by the BBC and in the school system, thanks to like the Acorn microcomputer that was sent to all the British schools, how to code. And so they were self-taught coders, and this led to the creation at Cambridge of the first computer science degree program in the world. And so Martin Hollis, the director of GoldenEye, attended that. He was the first computer science graduate, university graduate, that Rare had ever hired. So Rare had no problem making games before Martin Hollis and his like arrived, because all of these men had been taught, you know, like nationally, you know, there was just a push toward like, we need to learn how to code. And there have been some great books out about that and about, you know, just like what, like this very special way that the UK was really leading the world in computer advancing at this moment.
They didn't want to do Tomorrow Never Dies, did they?
No, I think that they just got bored. I mean, these were like really creative, really obviously free-spirited, independent guys, and they didn't like being told that they could or couldn't do anything. So when Rare and Nintendo came to them and said, hey, do you want to make a sequel that could make lots of money? They were like, no, we want our creative freedom. We're bored. We want something new. They loved sci-fi, and they had been watching, you know, Blade Runner and La Femme Nikita, and they wanted to make their own IP, their own sort of characters and world. And so they made Perfect Dark instead.
So it was a great game. That was a brilliant game, to be fair.
Yep. Used the same engine as GoldenEye, right? So it's kind of like the spiritual successor. It plays a lot of the same. But yeah, they were able to. And it was important. Martin Hollis has talked about how it was important to put a woman in as the lead, too.
Yes.
They had always felt a little, you know, like, okay, like, you know, we've got some strong women in the GoldenEye game, but wouldn't it be cool to have a female hero?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And more people were like, we want a GoldenEye sequel, And they were more. Well, Perfect Dark's the GoldenEye sequel, not Tomorrow Never Dies on a different console and totally different type of game. And they've sort of treated that as the follow-up to GoldenEye.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, especially for listeners of your podcast, I think that's a really important thing to point out, is that people really wondered when the game came out, like, how much of this game being awesome and being so well-loved and so well-received is about the game design, and how much of it is about Bond? And so the fact that you took the same engine, the same, you know, the exact same gameplay, but changed the story and the characters and removed it from the Bond context, and it flopped. I mean, it's a beautiful game. We know that. It's like, it's an incredible, incredible game, but it did not sell. And part of that was the timing, right? The N64 was nearing the end of its lifespan, and they should have waited and put it on the GameCube, and they didn't. But also, I mean, I have to think that people really loved playing as Bond, and they loved the spy stuff, and they loved the universe of Bond that you got to enjoy in GoldenEye. And that's just, you know, not something that Perfect Dark had.
The game has actually got more of the elements in it, the traditional Bond elements, than some of the recent films. You know, it's got the gun barrel for a start, and with Pierce Brosnan animating coming across. I mean, that for me, you're like, I didn't appreciate then that you could sort of make a video game like a film itself, like you were in the film. And I think it did that. And then, you know, before each level, you had the mission briefing, you had your watch with the gadgets, and it's just, you know, it's exactly, certainly with me and a lot of people thought, my word, this is exactly what I would have done as a Bond fan if I was trying to create a Bond game. Without realizing that's not to take away the genius of these guys, because they're the ones who did it. It's got exactly everything that you would have wanted at the time as a Bond fan.
You're totally right. I mean, it's following up on Doom, where all you're doing is running around and shooting, and things are exploding, and it's just, you know, run and gun. And so they were really careful, but they wanted you to feel like Bond. They wanted to really lean on that IP and that identity. And so that's why there's so many gadgets, there's so many stealth missions. It's also why at the beginning of every mission, you might remember that before you're immersed in that first person perspective with your gun there, the camera sort of will twirl around the top of Bond's head and then sort of like go down and come in from behind his head. And then you are sort of like merged with the camera in Bond's eyes, if you know what I mean. And the reason they did that is because they were like, well, it's a Bond game, but it's first-person shooter, so you never see Bond. So that's kind of a bummer. How can we remind the player that they are James Bond? And so that's why you have him doing those cool poses as the camera kind of comes and merges, and there might be cutscenes at the end of every level so that you remember, like, I'm wearing a cool tux, and I'm James Bond, and I look awesome, and I'm doing awesome things. But even something as small as the game designers recently said on Twitter that the way the gun barely moves when you are shooting someone with the auto aim, it just kind of moves just a tiny bit, is meant to capture that really cool and collected. James Bond is never ruffled. He's never panicking. He's never sweaty. He's just like very, very small motion, precise, cool under pressure. And so I think that's really cool that they knew how important it was for players to just like feel like Bond, and they wanted to play that out big time.
Yeah, I was going to say the thing that I think what makes it so kind of unattainable in a way is that it's kind of like a three hitter. It's a successful Bond game. It's a successful licensed game, which we know from even up till now, they still license games that are terrible because usually they're done cheaply and they're just using some assets from whatever media it's from, and it's rubbish. But also it is really bringing, you know, first person shooters to kind of a more mainstream audience, whereas, you know, something like PC, I feel like PC gamers are so much about now, and it's so much more normalized. But I think it's really easy to forget that PCs back then were not as easy for people to access. Not every household had one, and even if you had one, that didn't necessarily mean that you were going to play a game on it either.
Yeah, and the role that GoldenEye the game brought to, you know, connecting players to first person shooters leads me to believe that like you have GoldenEye to thank for Call of Duty, Halo, Fortnite, any of these contemporary first person shooters. It's not that they wouldn't exist without GoldenEye, it's just that like GoldenEye was the path that led to those in terms of people's awareness of the genre. And so yeah, it's pretty cool like that you have James Bond to thank for the evolution of modern first person shooter gaming. Yeah. The other thing about that I forgot to mention, just the immersion into the Bond universe, and to which the game developers used assets from the film, from GoldenEye the film. They had set design blueprints, they had floor plans, they traveled to the studio where they were filming GoldenEye, and they took pictures of everything. So there are things you see in the movie, like Boris's shirt is literally in the game, is a photograph of the actual shirt from the costume department for filming the movie. So I think that's pretty cool too, is that it is like you are playing the film.
I mean, like the GoldenEye Mission Control Room, I remember seeing it in the game, and because you can explore it so much, I loved when I went back to watch the film, noticing in the background that it was exactly the same. And you wouldn't have noticed that unless you'd played the game. And it makes it so authentic, the whole experience.
Yeah, it's incredible. And I you don't hear about that anymore, about like, you know, the guys who made Spider-Man are not going to the studio to look at the Spider-Man set. Like it really is like a very unique time in gaming history. And in, I would add, like, you know, just filmmaking and like British history, that this could all happen the way that it did.
Yeah.
That they just hopped in the car and drove to, what is it, Leavesdale?
Leavesden, yeah. That's amazing, yeah.
Hi, I'm Star Parodi.
And I'm Jeff Fair.
And we're the creators of the music for the Bond GoldenEye teaser trailer, the Parodi Fair version. And you are listening to the amazing...
Really 007.
When did you first play it, Elise, the game?
I can't even remember like the very first time. It just kind of feels like I grew up with it and it was always there, right?
Yeah.
It's like playing tag or hopscotch or something or jumper. Like it's just like there was always GoldenEye. It was just always there. But I think some of my most favorite memories of playing the game are in college. I'd play on four-player mode with my boyfriend, my best friend, and her boyfriend, and we would all just be in these four-player death matches. We did all kinds of games together. We played Euchre and Kemps and GoldenEye together, and we were always just looking for something to, you know, release probably a relationship and roommate tension around, and it was just a lot of fun.
And had you seen the film before you played the game?
I hadn't seen it before. No, I saw the movie after playing the game, which I think quite a few people did. And then it becomes kind of like, I did the same thing with The Last of Us, right? Like you play the game and you see. But it is fun to sort of be like, oh yeah, like he's in the vents, just like when I'm in the vents at the start of the facility mission. And it's just a lot of fun to see how they're in conversation with each other.
That's another great game. I know, Sam, you've been chatting cinema savvy, haven't you?
Yes. Well, I mean, The Last of Us was kind of the game, the university game. When I was at university, that was the game that was out, and that was the game that me and my friends played together. So even though it wasn't multiplayer, it was like, you've got a turn, and then once you die, this person's having a turn. And when you die, I've got a turn. And it was kind of just like passing that about. But actually, I remember that same year that we played that, I went with a couple of my friends to one of their friends' houses, and she had an N64 and she had a bunch of games. So it was probably the last time, was probably about 8 years ago, that I played four-player GoldenEye in person. And it was one of those really random nights that I did not even expect. But it was like, okay, you've got a golden N64 controller. We're having pizza. We're doing this. And it was like, it was kind of like, wow, I bet this is what people in the late 90s would have experienced at the time. And it just felt really surreal that it just was so random and that that happened.
Can everyone sort of say what their favorite bits of the game were? I know it's quite difficult to say, but you know, it might necessarily be a level, but it might be, say, just drive your tank. I mean, that's not bad, is it?
Well, it's amazing. I mean, I've got a few. It's been a long time since I've played it. What I always remember loving was the poetic licensing they had in terms of adding bits more to the story.
Yeah.
So you're like, your first level, Severnaya. So the film starts, like, you know, with the bungee jump. But you've got this whole level that they've created before to get to the jumping off point. And there's a story for that. And I always loved that because it was seamless. It never felt contrived. It felt like this could just have been part of the film. And I loved, like, because there was objectives, weren't there, in each one. And I think I remember, you know, I don't want to say this wrong, it wasn't one of the objectives at the start, find 006 or you contact 006 from that first bit. And I loved that. There was a bit, I remember... There's a shoot 'em up in Severnaya, isn't there? In terms of, there's a bit where he's going through the snow and you have to shoot bad guys, armored guys there. And I remember as a kid absolutely loving that they have taken the time to add bits that weren't in the movie to make this a full level. Just take snippets from a movie into a full level. And I always remember that level, that idea of creativity and the writing. To this day, I don't think has ever been matched, really. I really love that about it.
It is difficult because I was so young when it was out. Even though I played it when I was probably, well, I was definitely too young to play it, being like, what, 6 years old? I was definitely not old enough. But so I don't think there's anything from back then that particularly like sticks out as, oh, this is like the best bit of it. But I definitely, in kind of retrospect and after playing it in recent years, it is the humor that's in it. Like, there's some that's subtle and there's some that's just so in your face. I mean, Moneypenny's intros just make me actually laugh out loud because it's so, would have read that as a kid and I just, no idea. But nowadays, and I'm just like, you know what? And I think that's the thing about, you know, these guys who've made it, the fact that they've managed to like put so many things in there, and it's just so funny. It just feels such a thing that that some guys in the 20s or early 30s would just do just for a laugh. Yeah. And I don't think, I just think it adds a personality to the game. It adds, you know, a persona that you don't necessarily get with, you know, very streamlined, sleek games nowadays. It's very rare unless you're a kind of an indie company.
I'd forgotten about those Moneypenny intros. Because it had the text, didn't it? It didn't have the voices. It had lines underneath, which is fine because, you know, it might have been a bit distracting when all... if you've got... Well, I know with Nightfire, they had Maxwell Caulfield's voice, didn't they? Not Pierce's. Because most of the other characters were new, it didn't matter that, you know, the voices were fine. But if you'd had all the actors being done impressions, so you could have had a Robbie Coltrane impression, couldn't you? And then a Sean Bean one. It might have been a bit distracting. So I didn't mind that they just had the text.
Those mission briefings are a really cool way to bring the rest of the Bond universe in so that you can have a Moneypenny and M and all of that. And there were some little jokes like slappers as slang for, you know, sex workers or chopper as slang for penis that went right over American audiences' heads and that I did not get until I was researching this book. I kind of love that. That there were things that we just totally missed. But yeah, I think for me, it's just that handcrafted quality. I mean, as a kid, obviously, I just loved the feel of sniping and progressing and meeting all the objectives, and where I loved the stealth levels. I thought those were so fun that you just had to be so quiet and you had to karate chop people and throw knives at them and all of that. But I think now looking back on it, what feels so refreshing is that everything is handcrafted. There's nothing procedurally generated. There's nothing that, you know, is kind of copied and pasted, you know, from another dungeon or whatever. Everything is... Everything you feel someone put effort into, and you know that because they often put their initials on it, and
yeah.
Literally, like, little Easter egg graffiti and things like that. And I like the messiness there, that it feels like people made this, they were having fun when they made this, and they wanted to share that love of Bond and that love of their childhood connection to this figure with me.
That's so good. I just remembered another thing from the book that you say about Oddjob. He's really small in the multiplayer. He's really small. And, you know, it's again, like you said before, Sam, the Mandela effect. And you think, oh, is it because you think it's because they got mixed up with him and Nick Knack or something like that, and that they made him really small? Yeah. Because he's not. Oddjob wasn't that small. He did crouch a bit, chuck the bowler hat. But that, and then that made him a better player in, of course, in multiplayer, because there's less of him to shoot compared to Jaws.
Yeah, that the developers sort of knew that they were going to create controversy by giving players a way to cheat. But yeah. they thought that was hilarious. A lot of their decisions on what to do or what not to do in the game were based on what was funny. Was fun. And so they thought it was hilarious that there would be this character that was half the height of all the others and you couldn't hit him because the auto aim wouldn't pick him up. And they just thought that was so funny. And they sort of imagined an experience as they were playtesting these fights that would break out on a couch when it's like, dude, you can't do Oddjob. It's cheating. And they just loved that. They loved creating like a social dynamic problem that kids would fight over. And they thought that was really funny.
There was a bit that I found was so funny when two of them are talking to one another, and it's, I think you're going to be the one getting up and making the next pot of tea. And then the other one goes, you're going home in an effing ambulance, which I just thought was such a funny thing and just makes you think, oh yeah, these are just like average people who are just like one saying one thing, next one's just going to raise the bar like to an 11. You go, and I like that you say, oh, you go from like a British point of view to kind of like American smack talk. I just thought it was so funny.
Yeah, because I'm on the line with these guys on Zoom interviews with these developers, and they're like, yeah, there was a lot of smack talk. And I'm like, I'm having trouble imagining that because you're so sweet and quiet and polite and humble and like what did that sound like, you know? And then they gave me those examples that most of the time it was just, oh, you know, you're gonna have to go put the tea on. And I was like, that's adorable that you think that's smack talk. It's not smack talk.
Another thing we haven't mentioned is the music. I mean,
ooh, yeah,
dearie me, just having it on the pause screen, I remember Rob, we just had it on in the background if we were doing something else, you know. It was just, it's almost like trap, I keep saying, it's like trap music. And there's that meme someone's done of them dancing, you know, to the beat. And, such great memories again.
Yeah, the music just, it had no reason to go as hard as it did.
Yeah.
It just, you know, you just have these two guys, Graham and Grant, and they are really polar opposites. I talk about this in the book, but one of them is like a classically trained Royal Academy of Music trumpet player who then joined a heavy metal band and is just like a very gifted, natural musician. And then you had Grant, who sort of is like a goth electronic music guy. He loves electronic music, and he's really into like subtlety and eccentricity in his music. And so when they came together, it's sort of, you'd think it would just clash, but they were just able to use that chemistry to make so many cool riffs on the Bond theme, and just use that Monty Norman, you know, amazing, amazing, iconic soundtrack to do even cooler things. I still, you know, will, if I'm working on emails or something, I'll just turn on the GoldenEye soundtrack because I feel very cool with whatever I'm doing.
And it also channeled into the Eric Serra, the sort of Soviet thing, didn't it? Which again makes it an extension of the film.
Especially that sound of like the pipe clanging. You know, that weird percussion.
Yeah. With the actual process of getting this information, I mean, just a couple things about those actual the members of staff, like one, kind of how easy was it to get in touch with these members of staff, and what was that process of actually, you know, setting up these calls, speaking with them, you know, how long did that take? Because I find that from kind of like a research point of view, that is a really interesting thing to get kind of that first hand experience and to get that knowledge directly from them.
Well, it was really refreshing, first of all, to be able to speak with them, because for the Super Mario 3 book, you know, Nintendo is notoriously closed-lipped, and they were all under privacy contracts, so I couldn't speak to anyone who worked on the Mario game. I got to speak to some of the folks who helped market it through Nintendo of America, but all the rest was just relying on existing interviews. So it was amazing to have such access to the GoldenEye guys, and mostly that was because of their generosity with their time. They were so incredible to work with. My strategy was really to kind of start with David Doak, since he's the most vocal. He'll talk to anyone. He's always talking to people about GoldenEye on Twitter. He replies to people. He does tons and tons of interviews. And I knew this from sort of reading everything that was out there already. So I already knew what they had all said before. I listened to many hours of YouTube interviews and podcast presentations and read lots and lots of oral histories and interviews. And so I knew what I needed to ask them, and I wasn't going to just repeat the same questions to them. So I approached David Doak and told him about the project. And he was, of course, really excited to talk to me. He loves to talk GoldenEye to journalists and media. And then from there, I was really just hoping to build up trust with him so that he would help connect me to some of the rest of the team who are a little more, a little quieter about giving interviews, especially recently, like Martin Hollis. And so from there, you know, he kind of vouched for me. He's still in touch with all the other guys. I contacted some of them directly. I asked him to put me in touch with others, and they all said yes. In the end, I talked to every single one of the developers and composers, mostly over Zoom. Some of them sent me emails, but they were incredible because I was able to ask them these more nuanced or niche or specific questions. And I think that they really liked the idea that there was going to be one documentary project that could kind of gather together all the lore and all the development history in one place. Mm-hmm. And I say this in the book, they were just so humble. I mean, I would try to praise the game and they would kind of wince and brush that compliment off, and they didn't like it. I wasn't sure if that's just a British thing, but they were like, no, like, the game's not as good as you think it was, or I didn't do as much on it as you think I did, or just the most humble, sweet guys. And when it came time to check their quotes, I like to send all my sources their quotes so they can make sure that it sounds like what they actually said. Mm-hmm. And I just sent them the whole book so they could see their quotes situated in context. And what ended up happening is that more than one of these developers sent me back copy edits, like, hey, you missed a comma on page 91. It was just amazing. They were so generous with their time that they actually wanted to help copy edit the book with me. And they shared code from the game with me. I have a bunch of GoldenEye's code sitting in my Gmail. It was just incredible generosity from those guys.
That's excellent. That's so cool.
We might be able to talk to them eventually. That'd be great.
Oh, I'm sure David Doak would come on your show.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't want to give his answer for him, but he's everywhere. He's very extroverted, and he's a lot of fun to talk to. Very funny guy.
Such a niche character for people to know, but everybody playing the game knows him now, don't they? It's such
totally.
A usual one-off situation. But that's brilliant. Dear me. Well, thank you very much, Elise, for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Really appreciate it.
I know we've just talked about GoldenEye, but I'm sure we can, you know, talk about other stuff on another occasion. But I just want to, again, big up your book. I think it's magnificent. Mm-hmm. I think everyone should get a copy, because it's not the normal making of story. It's a really interesting background as we've said, the phrase, haven't we, lightning in a bottle, that it really was. And when you're sort of our age and you grew up with it, it sort of gets that cozy feeling again, and the memories of childhood. You just want to pick up the game and somehow play it if we can.
Yeah. But I mean, I definitely loved just the whole idea that those guys were on this sort of Bond-like mission, right? To do something against all odds that seems impossible and seems, insurmountable challenges. And they relied on all of their skills and prowesses, just like Bond would, to pull it off.
It is, isn't it? Yeah, but mission complete. But well, thanks, Elise. We do really appreciate
you.
It's just great to chat with somebody who, well, is from a different persuasion. I know, in fact, you're a professor, aren't you? That's university there in Denver, which is incredible.
Yes, I'm a creative writing professor, and I do a little bit of gender studies and things like that. But I did get to talk to a Bond professor for the book, a guy who's just an expert in all things Bond, and he gave me some really cool literary insights into the novels and their connection to his whole job. And there's compendiums of academic articles about Bond and scholarly takes with different theories and psychoanalytic Freudian theory on Bond, and it's just endless, right? So it's so fun to make that an object of study.
They had in England, they had David Beckham studies. So I think surely you can do a James Bond degree. Really? Yeah, yeah.
But what's this professor called? It's not Professor Dent, is it? No. No, okay.
No.
His name is Jeremy Strong.
And it's wonderful to get to know people from across the world. And
yeah, the Bond it's community. Reason.
Just like Bond going to all these exotic locations.
Yes, it's true. Yes, your podcast is really globetrotting.
Well, Denver's a very beautiful place, so I'd love to visit there sometime. But yeah.
Hey, if y'all are ever over here, please come visit. We'll have a good beer and we'll do some hiking. It'll be great.
Amazing. Awesome. Lovely.
Thank you so much, Elise. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me. It's just so fun. I really appreciated the conversation.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Got to get the book, haven't you, Sam?
Oh, yeah. No, I was like, as soon as I found out, I was like, well, this just gives me an opportunity to get another book, so I'm going to just get the book. Like, that's just what's going to happen. So
I appreciate y'all's support. Thank you.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.